there's a systems principle called Conway's Law that talks about how your software is going to be a mirror image of the communication structures that kind of the organization that creates that system uses. So if you've got a hero culture, it's going to be really hard to move to a continuous deployment way because your communication structures don't uphold it. And this happens the same with like one of the trends in software is moving to microservices, right? So if you've got a command and control where like one person has to be in control and vet everything, you will never be able to move to microservices. We laid off a client because we were just like, your culture doesn't support us being able to do this work.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for technical managers and founder and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Andrea Goulet. She is co-founder and CEO of CorgiBytes and founder of Legacy Code Rocks. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here today. And let's start with CorgiBytes and Legacy Code Rocks. I'd love to hear what those are and what your overarching mission is.
Sure. So people ask me, Corgi, like the dog? And so we're not a dog walking service, I promise. But our tagline is old code, new tricks. So what we do is take code that might be sluggish or slow, or maybe it was sloppily written, and we modernize it and we make it more stable, more scalable, and more secure. And so I like to use the analogy of, if you've ever been seen like the HGTV shows like Property Brothers or, you know, This Old House or something like that, what those folks are doing for physical structures, we're doing for the digital structures. And it's incredibly rewarding work. I got into it because my business partner was somebody that I went to high school with. And at our 10-year reunion, he wanted marketing help. And he said, I have this business. I've been running it for a year, but I don't understand people. I understand code. And in order for me to succeed, I'm going to have to get somebody who understands people. Mm-hmm. And I had been writing a blog. My background is in marketing and strategic communications. And so he approached me and said, you know, I've put a lot of thought into this, and I'd rather have 49% of something amazing than 100% of nothing, which is what I've had for the past year. Mm-hmm. And so he invited me to be his CEO kind of right off the bat. Having known me for like 15 years, I mean, that sounds like, you know, but
it's awesome.
It ended up being a great experience. And so through that, we discovered that what Scott loves doing more than anything else, we were watching an episode of This Old House, and he was like, I just want to remodel like all the code out there. There's so much legacy code and no one wants to work on it. And I always want to work on it, but people won't put me on those projects because they keep wanting me to build features. And he saw the problems very clearly. And, you know, the job that I did was come in and kind of help articulate it. And so it's been a really fun, we've been in business now 10 years. So I've been with business 9. Mm-hmm. And 3 years after starting the business together, we actually got married too. So it's been a really fun ride.
Yay. Oh, that's a great story. I love stories that's like that. It doesn't have to, but that's so cool.
No, it doesn't. But yeah, for us, it worked out really well. It worked out really well. And I think that's the idea behind Legacy Code Rocks. Was about three years ago, maybe four, mm-hmm. we went to a conference, and there were all of these other people who loved legacy code as much as we did, or at least making it better. And that's where we found the most fulfillment. And we had started using this term, kind of, there's makers out in the world. So there's Make Magazine and Maker Faires and make everything. Mm-hmm. And so we started using the term menders to describe people who love fixing things and who love making things that already exist better. And, you know, we found a community of other menders at that conference and just wanted to stay in touch. So we started up a newsletter and we had a Slack channel, and then that turned into a podcast. And so that's been kind of going as a community site for several years. And it's been incredibly rewarding to talk to so many people who just have a passion for making things better and who previously had felt incredibly alone and incredibly isolated, and also felt a lot of shame because the software industry really lionizes people who do the making and greenfield and everything. And I'm starting to see that shift a little bit. And I'd like to think that maybe, you know, a little bit that was kind of our part of the conversation. But it's neat now to see things like digital transformation being a real thing that's talked about in government and in enterprises, and knowing that that's something that we've been doing for 10 years and kind of leading the way in how we do that.
Mm-hmm. It's so cool, the idea of makers versus menders. So let me see if this is the way that I would understand it, and you can let me know if this is along the lines of how you see it. So I don't code, I'm not a coder, but I am a writer. And so you can approach it in a similar way. I've found that those analogies are kind of usually at least applicable. So when I think of the makers, I think of so when I think of the makers, I think of the people who just kind of love, it's like a blank page in front of me, let me just write and build something new, versus the menders are the ones who like to edit. They're like, give me something that's like, maybe it's old, or maybe the language is too clunky,
right?
And I want to fix it. So is that a similar thing?
I think that's, I come as a background as a writer too, and that's absolutely how I think of it. And I think the other way that I sometimes think of it, and it's not that like the people who like being editors can't write, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I can totally work off of a blank page if I need to, but it's more about preference and kind of where do you draw your energy from?
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, I think of it sometimes too as the introvert extrovert kind of spectrum.
Sure.
Where it becomes important when we start thinking about teams and we start thinking about where we put people is what's going to feed their energy level. Like Scott totally can build new features, but he feels slow. It doesn't like he's not feeling like he's doing his best work when he's put on a feature team. Mm-hmm. But if you put him right alongside customer service and he's the person who's kind of helping squash all of those bugs that are around that are driving everybody crazy. Like normally it's hard to find somebody who would fill that, but Scott would absolutely raise his hand and say, I love doing that type of work. And so it, you know, again, it's not that he can't do that or can't, but it's more about where do you find your energy? What kind of work do you love and what kind of work is going to bring you the most joy? I'm kind of right in the middle, and I am with writing and everything, and even introvert, extrovert, I'm an ambivert.
Yeah.
So too much time by myself and I start craving people, too much time around people and I crave time by myself. So I'm kind of the same with the makers and menders. Like I love kind of starting a new project, but then I want to see it to completion. And then, you know, so I'm kind of like right in the middle.
And that's a great analogy, thinking about it as a preference, thinking about it as what brings you joy, what is your default, and a great point about how we form teams. Just like on any given team, maybe the ideal would not be to have a whole bunch of extroverts or a whole bunch of introverts, or at least on the ends of the spectrum, that you would want some makers, some menders, and some people who fall in the middle.
Yeah, and I think it also depends on where your business is in the product life cycle. So Scott and I, and this will be hard without a visual, but I'll do my best to describe it. Mm-hmm. So I have a business background, and there's the product life cycle that is like a bar chart, and it's like it was in every single class that I ever had, mm-hmm. where it was, you know, introduction, growth, maturity, decline. And it was like a bar chart, and then at decline, it like starts going down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the first place that we were starting to kind of talk about this, I was like, I think there's some maker mender, like this might map here somewhere. And Scott, it was an agile conference that we were looking at pitching to. And he goes, that has to be a circle because we're talking about agile and agile people love circles. And they love to be.
Good point.
And so just for spite, I put it in a circle and I was like, see, that makes no sense. And he goes, no, actually it could. Because what if a business didn't have to decline? What if it just reinvented itself?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, and so it was really enlightening. And at that point, we could draw a very horizontal line and just see that in the growth and introduction phases, introduction and growth phases, mm-hmm. that's where you want that maker energy. Yep. Because ideas are really ephemeral. You don't want to write them all down because it's like they're not going to be sticky. And then when you move in from growth into maturity, that's when you really need that mender energy. Mm-hmm. So for us, we start seeing a lot of teams or companies where they have what we sometimes call a successful mess, where it's like, it's amazing, right? They've built it, they've got it off the ground, but now the number of users who can use it at a specific time, like at the same time, concurrent users is limited, mm-hmm. right? So they're starting to run into real operational problems because of the way that their code base is built. And the makers who originally built the, you know, first draft, if you will, mm-hmm. aren't excited about going in and kind of making it scalable or more performant. But mm-hmm. the people on my team, that makes us so excited, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's more about knowing at which stage in a business are you going to have the right energy. Yeah. So, you know, just like I know a lot of enterprise companies, they have kind of these skunk works teams that are makers, where it's like, okay, take something that is, you know, on the verge of decline and let's really experiment. And that's the opposite side, right? Like that's that mm-hmm. reinvention. Mm-hmm. So it's knowing kind of where and when to deploy certain, you know, kind of personality types, if you will.
That's great. And if you could create like a, I'm scratching little, like little, a circle with an arrow and I crossed out decline and wrote reinvent. It would be so cool to have like a little, like a cartoon or something like that. If you don't already have one, that would be so awesome. Especially like filling in the places where those makers and those menders might be best, but then also ways to make sure like the menders could stay engaged in high energy during the intro and growth phases and how the makers can do the same during that, you know, sort of that maturity and you know, like with the skunk work projects and stuff like that. It's awesome. Yeah, it's a great model to think about.
And
this.
That's what we see too, is that by bringing on menders at the right time, it actually frees makers up to make more because when where we're writing, like this is a great analogy, like you write everything down first. Like you don't stress too much about, is it the right word? Like you worry about editing later. Like that's kind of a separate process.
Yep.
And sometimes the same thing happens with code, right? And it's, you know, for good or bad, there are a ton of different philosophies, right? But a lot of times when systems get built, there's a lot of duplication or, you know, there are a lot of methods or business logic that's really embedded in places where, you know, it could be extracted. And by doing that work, what you're doing is actually making your making team way more efficient so that they can deploy changes way faster. Mm-hmm. Because what happens if you don't is the term technical debt, which is basically where, you know, a system becomes clogged with inefficiency, right? The visual there might be like, I had a garden this summer and it just, at first I was like, oh, I'll take care of the weeds. And I did like 15 minutes every day. And then eventually the weeds just completely took over and I just gave up on my gardening altogether. And that's kind of what happens with technical debt. It's like all of these little things that's like we don't want in our code base, but if we don't address them, like on a more systemic level, like, so next year I'm going to do raised beds, right? Like there's infrastructure changes that need to take place in order for me to do well. And the same thing has to happen in our code bases where there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to happen in order for things to happen. But sometimes it's like, we just feel like, oh no, we just need to bushwhack all of the stuff and we need to keep using these outdated systems even though they're fighting against us.
Yeah, and that's a great image, the weeds that can take over your garden, that your technical debt can take over your infrastructure and keep you from moving forward.
Yeah.
So that's the next thing that I wanted to talk about is technical debt. So before we get into the weeds, what I wanted to share was that the way that we met is that, just for our listeners, is that one of our colleagues, Marcus Blankenship, he is he's also a coach for technical managers. And just quick programming note, Marcus was on the podcast too. So check out Marcus's podcast on the People Stack. But the way that Marcus introduced me to Andrea was he said, she owns a company that specializes in repairing tech debt. How cool is that? I was like, wow, you know, that is very cool. Even as someone who, you know, I've never coded, but I help people who do, and I'm always around people who do. It is very cool to know that there's a company out there that specializes specifically in that. And so I was going to ask, before we get into, like, what does that look like? You know, what does it really mean to repair technical debt? We need to understand what it is in the first place. And I love, again, the weeds metaphor. So it's essentially like, maybe to bring the writing analogy into, so we got a couple analogies, where it's like, if a bunch of people, like you have this book and a bunch of people just keep adding this stuff to the book. And over time, you have to have a systematic way to kind of take out some of the inefficiencies. You end up with garbage.
Exactly. Exactly. It's really separating the signal from the noise. The way that we describe it is that anything that gets in the way of a developer being in perfect flow and being completely efficient. And so that can be different things for different people. But what's interesting is just how much writing and communication and empathy really come into play. When I first got into software, I was like, okay, Scott, like, I'll help you run your business, but I'm not going to code. Like, I'm a business person, right?
Yep.
I'm a marketing person. I don't know how to code. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really struck me was that from the very, 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 very beginning, he goes, no, the way that you think about communications and writing is very much like programming. Mm-hmm. You're just calling it something different. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is that over the years that, you know, technical debt, it's in so many different places in our lives, like writing, like owning a home, right? You can think of it as clutter in a house, right?
Yeah.
Like if you don't take the time to wash your dishes, then eventually you're going to have a hazmat team that has to come in. Right. If you never take out the trash. And it's so there's a, like, on the homepage of our website, I call us the joyful janitors of the internet, because a lot of times it is taking care of those things that feel really mundane, but at the same time are really important to making sure that a team can flourish and that you can achieve whatever business goals that you need. So in the end of the day, it's the technical problems or the technical kind of cruft that's built up over the years or over time. And if you don't make a plan to, you know, pay that down in some way, if you're using the debt analogy, or cut back the weeds, or, you know, clean up the clutter, use whatever metaphor you want. Mm-hmm. But it does tend to be more of like a kind of capital investment. It's not something sometimes that's done on the weekend. Well, I'll take that back. It's both. It is small things that every developer does every single day. And some examples there might be writing really good just commit messages. So when they commit code to the code base, right, and when they deploy it, are they using natural language in a way that is clear and the person who's coming in 6 months later understands what they did?
So this is like the right? No. This is the code that I just put in there, and this is what it's about.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. In the source control system, it's like making the note and saying, this is what I did about. And there's a commit message, but there's also a description part of that too. And you can use that to really articulate what your thinking is. So that's a kind of a daily practice. Mm-hmm. Other ones might be technical or test-driven development, TDD. And so that would be writing tests before, you know, kind of the framework of that is red, green, refactor. So you write a failing test, then you make it pass, and then you kind of clean everything up so that, you know, it's easy to read. And that's kind of a daily practice that every single developer does, writing clean code or writing code using, if you're in an object-oriented language, using solid principles. So those are kind of daily individual practices that can help pay down technical debt. But there are also team practices, or I would even say executive-level practices, that it's really hard for the individual person to do, you know. And those would be, like, if we're going to talk about a metaphor, like if we're thinking about efficiency and we're thinking about a house, for example, like, yeah, there are clutter things, but then at the same time, there are things like replacing the windows or getting insulation, where it costs a lot up front, you know, compared to kind of your daily maintenance and your kind of operations budget. But you will save that money over time and eventually more than recoup that cost. And so those would be things, a lot of these are in the, you know, DevOps or developer operations world. So, you know, continuous deployment, you know, continuous integration, making sure that your developer environment is really, really easy to stand up. So then that way, if a new developer comes on a team, you know, they're up and running in 10 minutes versus 2 weeks. So, you know, kind of thinking of what's the lost productivity, and you can think of that on an individual level, but then also on a team level. And so if you're managing teams, there are definitely things that you can look at. And the thing that we do is we write reports, like we kind of go in, we assess, we look at the code base, and we're looking at both the individual levels, but then more often we're translating these really technical concepts into incredibly easy to understand, you know, instructions for an executive to just go, oh my God, I got it. I understand it now. Because I think that's the biggest disconnect, which is why I was really excited to connect with you. Because too often we're in these silos of like, I'm a writer, I don't know how to code, or I'm a coder, so I don't know how to write. Mm-hmm. And when we put ourselves in those silos, that's where technical debt just breeds.
Yes. And what's clear from that great description that you gave is that there's the daily stuff that can happen. There's the long-term stuff that can happen in terms of repairing the code and preventing that tech debt to even accumulate in the first place. Mm-hmm. What I'm curious about is thinking about when you go in and help a company to make their old code do new tricks.
Yeah.
What I'm curious about is how much of that time, and obviously I know this is going to vary, but how much of that time do you find yourself helping them actually repair the code, like really getting into the weeds, versus really diving into the organizational issues that may have caused that tech debt in the first place?
Yeah. So I think in the beginning of an engagement, for sure, we're talking more about the organizational side. And we produce a report and we kind of say here, and because all of the strategic investment needs to be in alignment in order for us to then dive in. But I would say after we've kind of got that roadmap and we've got the strategy planned out, then we shift focus, and it's about 90% of us in the weeds doing the work, working right alongside with their teams. I describe our teams as technical player coaches. So there are technical coaches who kind of come in and teach for a couple of weeks and, you know, we'll coach that way. But for us, we're like in it doing the work. And what that does is that because we are a team of people who naturally love doing this, the other people on the team are able to observe what it's like and then start practicing, and it's able to get over that like inertia of, because I think the biggest problem with technical debt and legacy code sometimes is that it is just this massive, you look at it and you're like, where do I even start? And so the biggest thing that we do is, you know, at the very beginning, just saying, okay, here's our assessment, here's where you should start. Everybody goes, okay, I think we can get on board with that. Okay, we're going to start there. And then we dive in and we start just like making progress. And then it becomes a virtuous cycle, because you make some progress here and you feel really good. And then you want to keep investing those resources.
Okay.
And then, you know, over a year or so, you know, sometimes 2 years or three, you start to see like, wow, I've got like a modern application and I'm able to hire really talented folks, you know, who are makers because now they're excited to work for us. You know, and you're starting to achieve those business goals that you've wanted, but that technical debt has kind of held you back. Mm-hmm. So that's where we feel really good, is seeing our clients really succeed because of the work that we've done.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. Another topic that I want to talk about, Andrea, because I feel like it permeates everything that we've been talking about. And it's essentially communication. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, writing, whether you're writing code or whatever it is you're communicating. Mm-hmm. And I noticed on your LinkedIn profile that one of the talks that you give is communication is just as important as code.
Yeah.
And I can venture a guess at how you might answer this question, but I'd love to hear how you approach it. So why do you see a need to talk about this topic?
Yeah, it's real. The first was because I was a writer and I was trying to find my place. Mm-hmm. So that my very first conference that I ever went to was like a regional Ruby conference. And I think I was the only woman. There were like maybe 300 or 400 people there. And I just felt so out of place coming from a marketing background where it's pretty diverse. I went to a very kind of monoculture. I was like, where is everybody who looks and thinks like me? Oh, they don't exist. And just, I'm the type of person where I tend to, if I have something to say, I'm going to say it. Mm-hmm. So I got up on stage and I gave a lightning talk, and it was, your code is awesome, your copy sucks. And it was about error messages.
Yep.
And I was like, here's how you write a good error message. Think like a human, like write to a human, don't write to the machine. Because the biggest problem that I see with error messages is that people write in a passive and third person like voice, like they're writing to the machine. They're not thinking about the human who was going to be consuming that. And so it was a quick 10-minute talk and was like, here are the basics of copywriting. This is what passive voice means. This is what active voice means. Use the word you. Make better error messages, please, please, please.
Yeah.
And it stood out, right? But it was the thing that I could speak from with authority, and that I didn't feel that sense of imposter syndrome.
Yep.
When I was on stage, that I do with some other talks, like when things, you know, I can talk about kind of containerization and things like that, but there are people who go way deep on that. And I just don't have, you know, 15 years of DevOps experience like other people. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's communication, and specifically strategic communication. So thinking about how do we get organizations to talk? And so that talk ended up, I got requests for like 5-6 years. People were like, I saw you give this lightning talk like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I should actually turn this into a thing. And so I did. And people started asking me to keynote pretty frequently. So yeah. I have that one. And then I have kind of its next iteration, which is empathy is a technical skill. And yeah. Because I think if you get to the heart of communication, what makes communication really, really good is being able to identify with your audience and really, and in a professional setting, solve a problem for them, right? So the way we define empathy at CorgiBytes is proactive, perspective taking, and problem solving. And there's a framework that kind of we train and we go through where before you commit something, you think through who is going to need to use this code and who's going to need to be aware of this change being made, right? And that could be, oh, well, I've got to write up some release notes, or, you know, the error messages. You know, I need to make sure that I'm writing to that human. And so we have kind of a framework that I walk through where it's, you know, if you can distill test-driven development down into red, green, refactor, I distill, you know, empathy-driven development, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. into audience and action. So being able to understand your audience really, really well, and that's being able to you know, as a writer, like these are the things that we take for granted, right? It's like I'm identifying and I'm forming a connection with an individual. Like when I write an error message, I'm not writing to the machine. I'm not even writing to a group of users. I'm not even writing to like a target audience of freelancers or whatever might be. Mm-hmm. I'm writing to Sally, or I'm writing to Jamal, right? I'm writing to an individual. And that's the difference between really good communication and kind of okay communication. So the thing that I think we miss as communicators is that we understand empathy, and we understand this to the point where we've mastered it, and it looks like magic. Just like the people who are super analytical and know how to code. Like to me, when I first saw Scott code, I was like, what are you doing? It just looked like magic. And I was like, nervous to open up the terminal window. I was like, I'm going to break the internet if I type LS. Like I just, right, there is this fear.
Yes.
And so by recognizing that that fear exists on both sides, right? So people who understand machines and like just get how to communicate with them, communicating with humans, it's not that they can't do it, it's that they haven't accumulated that 10,000 hours of practice, and it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not impossible. And empathy is not a feeling. Empathy is a skill. Empathy is something that is done through practice, and it's something that we can empower everyone on our team to do, regardless of, you know, kind of where they come from. So that's, I think, at the real heart of how you move some of these legacy projects forward. Because what we often see is that, you know, Michael Feathers defines legacy code as code without tests, which I think is accurate. I also think it's a little bit incomplete. Mm-hmm. I think of legacy code as code without trust. You don't trust the code base. You don't trust the people who built the code base. You don't trust that the code, the documentation says, you know, it's going to do what it says it's going to do. So then how do we build up that trust? We build it up by having an understanding of who is interacting with this system. And we leave behind really good, what I call communication artifacts, for them to find and discover. And by doing that, then we build up trust in a way that is just exponential. I call it trust fission, right? Mm-hmm. This practice of just leaving really good communication artifacts for the humans on your team to find about your thinking about the code.
Mm-hmm. So this is all, it's awesome stuff. And it's stuff that I can definitely relate to as a career coach for technical managers. The stuff that you're talking about, empathy, fear, trust, these themes come up time and time again when we're talking about engaging with other humans and engaging them in conversations, and how we really build teams that are based on trust, that we learn to admit that, there is this fear, and how do we acknowledge it and move past it? And it's just, it's so great to hear it applied to something that can be seen as so non-human like code. But it sounds like what you're saying is, remember that there is somebody. So there's somebody who's going to be reading that code, whether it's, you know, somebody else on your team. But that ultimately also, that code is going to create this software that people are then going to get benefit out of. So seeing that bigger picture and not getting so wrapped up in the bits and bytes, right? Not getting so wrapped up in the individual words or the individual commands.
I think it's also recognizing that there are so many different places. Like, so one of the exercises that I did with a group in London when I was speaking there, is I had them just write down what are all of the places within a code base, or, you know, within a, you know, software project, where you need to create a communication artifact for another human to consume. Mm-hmm. Like, just here's a bunch of post-its, go.
Yep.
And it was just like they piled up.
Yep.
And then you can do kind of an affinity grouping, where you can like create, you know, kind of two different types of axes. So one of the ways I like to think about it is, what are all the synchronous events and what are the asynchronous events, right? Or what are all the things that are really terse, and what are all the things that are really verbose? So there are some things that are like maybe the size of a tweet, right? Or shorter, like they're a word, But then there are others where it's like, you know, you need to write some paragraphs, right? You really need to kind of dive into some rationale and kind of recognizing when do you deploy which thing. And when you kind of categorize it that way, it can, you can start to kind of make sense of things. And then you can recognize, okay, this person is more strategic and they don't code all the time. So I'm going to have to give them more explanation. So I'm going to, it's kind of like calling a method. I'm going to call the, you know, update report.
Sure.
Right? And in this sense, you can even think about like timesheets, right? Timesheets are a form of communication. And I always get an eye roll when I give this. But the reason that this is a benefit for the people who code every day is because if you're proactively providing this context, you get interrupted way less. And the benefit that you get is that you tend, once you create this environment of trust, you can then carve out large blocks of time where no one interrupts you and you can actually get your work done.
Yeah.
Because the number one reason that people interrupt you as a developer is because they need to know what's going on.
Yep.
So if you're ahead of time, you know, kind of writing what your thinking is and, you know, kind of what your thought process is, people don't interrupt you as often. So when developers ask me like, why would I do all of this work? It's, you know, that's the answer I give because
you're going to have more time. There's going to be more, and there's going to be more trust.
Exactly.
There's a question forming in my mind, and I will admit that I haven't quite formed it, so I'm going to talk it out. But one of the things that I've been thinking about as you've been talking about fear, trust, empathy, communication, writing code, teams, is that, so my husband and I, so my husband is CTO of the People Stack, so we work together on, you know, helping helping tech managers to build thriving, high-performing teams and upgrade their careers. And one of the things that we've been talking about lately is this concept of org smells. And he had to explain this to me, because there's the concept of the code smell. That your code smells. Like there's something fishy here, not quite sure what it is, but we're gonna dive in because there's something wrong. And so he's thinking about it and we're thinking about it from the perspective of the organization. What is that? Something smells fishy in this organization. Yeah. There's an org smell. And I guess my more general question is, what do you think about that idea of org smells? But also more specifically around how, what might be the org smells that would indicate that, you need to go in and fix your code.
Such a good question. So the first thing that comes to mind is the book Five Dysfunctions of a Team. The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, it talks about different dysfunctions that happen within a group. And so some of those might be like the absence of trust or, you know, not engaging in conflict. Like if we have a team where just everybody's agreeing all the time, that's kind of like, that's a little fishy. Like y'all should be having some, you know, conversations that are, you know, heated. I think specifically around code and around legacy code, some of the organizational smells are you can't deploy as fast as you want to, or deployments are taking way longer than they used to. So let's say, you know, you kind of were running Scrum for a while and you were using your kind of 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks you would deploy something new and everything was kind of running smooth. And now it's been 2 years and you've got, you know, a lot more customers, but you know, deployments are taking 6 weeks now. And what then happens is we see leaders who go, come on guys, like we need to get this out the door. And communication just really starts to break down because the technical folks don't understand the business implications of like, if we don't get this out the door, then we're going to lose money or, you know, and so everybody's operating under stress.
Another one that
I see is hero culture,
where
you have a team where they are praised and you get rewarded by self-sacrifice and by being a martyr. So for example, by like a lot of deployments happen on the weekends or in the evenings because you want to have minimal disruption. So those really gnarly ones where it's like, I was at the office for 18 hours straight on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Thanks. You know, like, and we reward that behavior.
Yeah.
But is that the behavior we want to reward, or do we want to reward the developer who takes that 18-hour deployment and then turns it into 18 seconds, and then you can easily roll back. So now you've got continuous deployment and you never have that situation happen again.
Yeah.
And that happens on a cultural level, because if you've got a hero culture, there's a systems principle called Conway's Law that talks about how, you know, your subsystem, so your software, is going to be a mirror image of the communication structures that kind of the organization that creates that system uses. So if you've got a hero culture, it's going to be really hard to move to a continuous deployment way because your communication structures don't uphold it. And this happens the same with, like, one of the trends in software is moving to microservices, right? So if you've got a command and control where, like, one person has to be in control and vet everything, mm-hmm. you will never be able to move to microservices. We laid off a client because we were just like, your culture doesn't support us being able to do this work.
Right.
So there absolutely are, you know, kind of organizational smells.
Yeah.
Are a sign of the technical debt. And I think the key is helping people who are on the business side understand it and recognize that oftentimes it's a systemic problem. It's not a problem with necessarily the individual developers.
Yes.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. The tendency tends to be, oh, this is easy. We need to just blame it on this one person. But it's usually that would actually be easy, right? Let's just make sure this person, let's help this one person. But it's the systemic stuff that the fear comes in. I've noticed
and
that.
And what I hear all the time is like, it's just one field. How hard can it be to change?
Yeah.
Right. And that you're right. That's not hard at all if your code is really clean and, you know, but it's like, it's just one piece of jewelry. How hard can it be to find, right? Like, if you've got a really clean and organized, you know, kind of structure, it's super easy to find. If your house looks like hoarders and you're looking for one specific thing,
sure.
You know, that's kind of the visual representation of what a lot of legacy systems look like.
Yep.
How can you ever expect an individual to find that? Right. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I use kind of the personal organizing, you know, kind of metaphor, because a lot of times it feels like what it is. And it's just as much as kind of the culture, and, you know, people slip into kind of old habits. We have one client that we love, and, you know, they're doing really great. And then it's like, you know, a big deadline comes up and a big business kind of objective comes up. And then we kind of fall back into old stressful habits. And so, you know, one of our core values, so communication is just as important as code. Yep. Act with empathy. Those are both part of our core values. Another one that we have is calm the chaos.
Yes.
And it's just, okay, take some deep breaths. We need to be operating from our prefrontal cortex and our, like, really good long-term thinking brain, not our lizard brain and limbic system mm-hmm. that's just telling us that this is fight or flight, do or die.
Yes. All good stuff. All great stuff. So definitely look out for those, you know, for those org smells. And also, thanks for the recommendation on the 5 dysfunctions of a team. I have it pulled up on Amazon. It's 5 dysfunctions of a team, a leadership fable by Patrick Lencioni. Awesome. Yeah. There's one version on Amazon that used to be $999. That's $523.86 now for some reason. But the other version in the Kindle is $12. So what's so special about that $1,000 book? But
it's a good one. I got the Audible version and I listened to it, and it's not very long, and it's good. I like the way you know, it's written as a story, which is nice.
It makes it easier to read. Like, you can mm-hmm. sit down and, like, I like that kind of stuff too. Rather, you know, sometimes I'm in the mood to read, like, systemic stuff, and here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes it's nice just to read a story and to, oh wow, I learned stuff from that too. It makes it easier on the brain. All right, Andrea. So we have one more question, and this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
I think the biggest people-related challenge is, for me, I think there's individually, and then there's, like, as a team. So I'll share both of them. So as a team, I think it's recognizing that you know, diversity is a really good thing. And kind of pitching the idea of, no, menders can come in and help. We can absolutely help, and we will more than pay back, you know, our value a lot of the times. And kind of figuring out what is that, you know, kind of what is that value, and training business people to really understand it. You know, it's been a really interesting challenge. We also work as a remote team because, you know, kind of finding this subset of developers, you know, we weren't going to find it in one metropolitan area. So we decided very early on we would have to be a distributed team. Mm-hmm. And so how do you foster this sense of empathy and the sense of camaraderie when you are all located in different physical places? That's something that I think about a lot. Mm-hmm. And then for me, I think I'm, you know, personally growing, and as the business grows, I am less and less in the project work these days. And so feeling, you know, sometimes a little isolated or a little different than kind of the rest of the team. And I personally sometimes want to kind of crawl back into the project work, but really what I need to be doing is leading and visioning. So, and I've heard the same thing with Scott, who's my partner. I think that transition from practitioner to leader is really, really, really hard. So that's one of the things that I'm currently kind of wrangling.
Okay. So, have you found particular actions, particular activities or rituals or whatever you might call them, things that you do on a daily basis that have helped you make that transition?
For me, I think it's about community and finding other people who are going through similar kind of transitions. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm enrolled in a program that Goldman Sachs sponsors called 10,000 Small Businesses. Mm-hmm. And it's just opened up this whole network of other successful business owners who are working on growing their business. And I'm like, oh, I'm not alone. Yeah. Right. So I think that's kind of the hard thing, is that, like, you know, feeling like I'm leading my team, but in order to lead, you know, I want to be part of it, but I also am struggling with sometimes challenges that, you know, they don't need to stress out about too much. I just need to figure out how to get it done. Mm-hmm. And so having that network of other people who are kind of working on the same thing has been huge. Yeah. And then there's like co-working spaces and things like that. But in terms of daily rituals, that's a struggle. That's a struggle for me. I really struggle with routine and ritual in general. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. That's why I ask. And I've asked a few of my podcast guests this, and some of them really geek out, including myself. I will admit and raise my hand and say, I'm totally a ritualistic person. And I really do geek out about that kind of stuff. And that's what helps them. But for other people, it's more about having that flexibility, that there's a bunch of tools, and which one do I want to use today?
Yeah.
Like, ooh, I get to do this one today and I don't have to use it every single day.
Yeah. Like today, this morning, not feeling constrained. Yeah. Like I think about it, like this morning. So autonomy is really, really, really big for us. Like that's our biggest cultural pillar. Mm. And, you know, so like I was stressed, like there's all this stuff I've got to do. And so, you know, this morning I was trying to figure out like, what are my three priorities for the day? And I was working with Scott to try to figure it out, because I was just like, I don't even know. I've got like 47 priorities. Like, how do I pick what's most important? And what rose to the top was yoga. Like, there's a yoga class that I love. And he's like, go do yoga, and then you will be very clear on what your other two priorities are for the day. Do that.
I love it. I'm like,
you're so right. And it's so funny. And I think that that's the perfect embodiment of calm the chaos, mm-hmm. right? And it's the antithesis of what we always feel like our society pressures us to do.
But
having that kind of environment, and we've been very intentional about creating an environment where not just me as the CEO can take 2 hours in the middle of the day at yoga, you know, but we actually offer yoga as, you know, something for our team. We have a virtual yoga instructor who like will help with shoulders and stuff to kind of augment the sitting at a desk all day.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it's been great. And so that's something that we've built in. And then also just anyone can kind of take up if they need to and kind of take a break. Mm-hmm. that's been a big thing. And so I think for me, just recognizing that I can take advantage of some of the benefits that I've built at my own company, because they are sometimes very, very, very different than what you would see at kind of a traditional organization. But they work for us. And that's why we're able to make good progress on, you know, these projects that otherwise seem intractable.
Yeah. And it sounds like you are really building a company and building a lifestyle for yourself that reflects that company. So the calming the chaos and the networking and the autonomy, that these are all things that are important to you, and you're creating a company where what it is as well. And like you mentioned, the networking, for example, that networking is important to you. Okay, there's other small businesses that are growing. And what I would see, like, as for your company, is that that's what you're doing for other people. You're showing them mm-hmm. that other people have been here. You're not mm-hmm. the only people who have technical debt and have made some mm-hmm. mistakes, or maybe lots of mistakes along the way. And
exactly.
We're going to help you do that. And that really does kind of it calms the chaos a little bit and makes you realize, all right, we're only human. We're going to make mistakes, and there's plenty of people out there who can help us.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, I hadn't thought of it but that way. But yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's been great talking with you today, Andreas. Thank you so much for taking a little bit out of your day to talk with me.
Absolutely. Thank you. This has been such a great conversation.
Okay, great. You take care.
All right. You too.
All right. So I'm going to press